Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabake. And this week, we're going to do another round robin on the news. We're going to talk about the Olympics. We're going to talk about cyber attacks. We're going to talk about billionaires in space. And we might even get an audio bomb by a four-year-old.
This is a really fun conversation. And I'm finding, Errol, with these, that it's a real production challenge to decide what to actually talk about and what not to. Like, there's so much happening in the world each week, and really kind of trying to take it in a structured way and surface the things that maybe are not dominating every headline but are also relevant is fun. It's a fun challenge.
Definitely. And I'm assuming that was also your four-year-old. So I'll just go and say, our challenge every week is, you know, trying to find an apple that is the right size so that we don't take too much of a bite, but it can't be too small that we leave out some of the major issues of the day. And so inevitably we will leave out stuff, but we will certainly talk about things that we think are important and offer all the lukewarm takes you can handle.
All right. Well, with that, let's get into it.
All right. Let's do it.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining.
You want to kick us off, Mike?
Sure. So I am coming this evening from my niece's birthday party. Happy 10th birthday, Kate.
Wait, is it at your house and you just like escaped to the basement?
No. We were out at their house.
Did you have time to get a beer?
I sure did. I am drinking another one from our friends at Green Man Brewery in Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
And tonight I've got the Demon Dweller Barrel-Aged Imperial Stout. This is it's got a really nice, complex flavor, like almost like an aged oak finish. But it's also 10% alcohol by volume. So it's like it's got this kind of mix of like a real – it's really subtle but also potentially deadly. It's basically like the fountain pen of beers.
The fountain pen of beers. Why are fountain pens deadly, just out of curiosity?
I mean, look at them, right? Like they could do some damage.
That's fair. I thought you were going to talk about penmanship or something, but you went the weapon route. Like
very metaphorically deadly. No, fair.
The script is deadly. I am working with pretty standard go-to, really, really delicious Bell's official hazy India Pale Ale.
Ooh, which, nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's my neighbor got me a six-pack for my birthday back in February, and she was like, oh, you like this, right? And I, of course I said yes, but like I didn't really know it all that well. And as I drank the six-pack, not all in one night, I definitely came to appreciate it more and more. And so when I was at the store earlier today and thinking about News and Brews, I was like, you know what? Let's just go like a pretty standard. I kind of really like this beer. The word they use to describe it on the can is pungent, which I think is quite fun. Pungent American hops combined with wheat and Pilsen malt result in a smooth, aromatic, juicy IPA, which I don't have the gift of gab like you do, Mike. So I can't come up with fountain pen metaphors, but you know what? I think Bell's got it right. I think that's juicy and pungent.
You know, I'll say the hazy IPAs are having like an extended moment and I'm pretty here for it.
I'm totally here for it. I like the hazy IPAs. I don't know what that means per se, other than is it cloudy and seems dirty when you pour it in a glass?
Yeah,
it never makes it to a glass.
Got the haze in the IPA.
Yeah, but who puts it in a glass? Anyways, so those are our brews. How about we talk about a little news?
Let's do it.
You know, last week we made this big deal, Mike, about like, we didn't talk about billionaires in space.
We took some pride in it. We thought pretty highly of ourselves. It's true.
And then, like a failed space rocket, we came crashing down to Earth.
The 52nd anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, when Neil Armstrong became the first human to set foot on another world, this Tuesday, Jeff Bezos became the richest guy to sort of go to space in the last week. The Bezos flight was noteworthy compared to Richard Branson's last week because Bezos is richer, he went slightly higher, and his spaceship looks way more like a penis.
I was wondering if there was some sort of joke about that coming in, but yeah, you went directly for the
Just
punch.
straight for it. It's like, you can only bring so much subtlety to as unsubtle a move as making a rocket that looks like that. If anyone hasn't seen it, look up a picture of this thing. It is aggressive.
It's weird looking. So I actually was putting my 4-year-old to bed and she was talking about space or rocket ships or something. And I was like, oh, I was a bad dad. I should have shown you the rocket launch. And then I thought after I said that, I was like, maybe, yeah, I'll go ahead and do it tomorrow. But he didn't go alone, Mike.
That's right.
He had the youngest person who has been in almost space with him, some really rich dude. Paid a bunch of money and then didn't go himself and sent his son or something.
Yep. Yeah, Dutch guy, right? Like a Dutch teenager was just kind of tagging along on this flight.
Yeah. I mean, where do you go from there?
Presumably a gap year.
If you're Dutch, I guess so. In New Zealand? But that's not all. Presumably there was a pilot on board as well, but I think the coolest passenger had to have been Wally Funk.
Absolutely. Yeah, 82 years old, the oldest person to ever go into space, and her story is just fascinating and really inspiring.
Yeah, we touched on this a couple weeks ago on News and Brews, but essentially she was a, I mean, Google Wally Funk, and it's spelled exactly like you think it is. She was really a trailblazer in the role of women in aviation and in particular space aviation. But for, a whole host of reasons that were out of her control, she never actually made it to space until now. And so we had brought it up a few weeks ago to give kudos to Bezos for bringing her along. And so kudos to Bezos for bringing her along.
As of the late 50s, she was a highly accomplished pilot, became part of the Mercury program way back when, like early NASA days, and then never actually made it into space, and now she has. So definitely a happy part of this story.
Yeah, definitely. I think the like comparing rocket sizes and heights stuff was sort of the least interesting part of this. I don't know, Mike. I mean, I sort of was a little bit more down on this last week because I don't know, billionaires in space doesn't really excite me, but I think you actually had a really good point. So tell us, like, does it bother you that there's been so much coverage of billionaires in space?
Listen, there's a lot of things that these people could be doing with their money.
Which is most of the point that Twitter was making.
Right. And fair enough, right? Bernie Sanders got in a good dig on, this being evidence that we just need to tax the billionaires more and more. And, he's been remarkably consistent in that position for like 40 years. So more power to him. That being said, like, if it's a choice between ever bigger yachts or space exploration, there are just so many other benefits that space exploration has for society, not least of which is these aren't just like hobby ventures that these billionaires are taking into space, right? They didn't just build the rockets for themselves. They're all trying to build viable businesses around them, including Jeff Bezos has talked about moving things like heavy manufacturing into space. So you move all of that pollution out of the atmosphere. So there could be a range of societal benefits that come from this type of exploration, much of which we can't even conceive of, as of the first couple of flights. And so I don't think it's a bad thing. My 4-year-old, for what it's worth, is enthralled by this and loves to talk about space and did a space week at daycare last week, all related to this. So I don't hate it, I'll be honest.
All right. Well, you've got a convert in me. I will think less disdainful when I see rich white guys go up in space. Because I think you're right. Like they are building an ecosystem, and like it wasn't like Bezos ordered a rocket kit on Amazon and then sent it up. Like he's actually got like a supply chain around him, and so hopefully that has other sort of side economic and other types of benefits over the years. So consider me converted.
Well, we'll come back around when Elon Musk decides to go up next.
As long as he doesn't talk about Dogecoin, then I'll like kind of sort of listen to him and not ignore him.
Yeah, he'll have like the spaceship equivalent of truck nuts just to kind of like take it a step further.
Speaking of ignoring people, so I haven't really been paying attention to Brazil for the past few years, in part
Few
because
years, just put it out of your mind.
Well, it's I so I've spent time in Brazil, and I think it's a fascinating place, and they've just had a really fairly not great president recently, sort of risen on the global populist coattails into power, and really didn't do well at all at the beginning of COVID, and joined with his other sort of far right brethren in denying and, you know, mocking, and, you know, it's sort of that's what he has made a name out of as president of Brazil. And so this week he was in the
But
news
this,
for entirely different reasons.
let me just first say that is literally the best summary of the conditions of a presidential administration in a country I've ever heard from someone who claims to have not paid any attention to that country.
Yeah, it's kind of the day job. I can't like totally ignore it.
This week, Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, of whom you just spoke quite eloquently, was hospitalized for uncontrollable hiccups that lasted over a week. After much speculation from Twitter doctors that this sort of ailment only comes from angering a wizard, actual hospital doctors determined the cause to be a blockage in Bolsonaro's intestine. We don't have too much to say on this, just that we wish him a speedy recovery and a clear digestive tract so he can get back to his usual excretions of pure bullshit from his mouth.
Twitter doctors is what, like, that should be a hashtag. I just feel like I'm going to be using Twitter doctors in regular conversation for the next like week.
You know, I think the age of COVID was just the age of the emergence of all sorts of Twitter experts en masse.
Yeah, and it's not just Twitter. I mean, it's across social media, right? I mean, we've got the Delta variant that's sort of ripping through unvaccinated populations in the United States right now, and there's a whole host of Twitter doctors. Although there seem to be six particular social media doctors that are spreading a majority of the misinformation about
Oh, we'll get
COVID
there. We'll get there.
vaccines. Foreshadowing.
Beautiful. Moving on, I want to revisit a story we talked about last week, which is Cuba. So last
Yeah.
week we talked about the historic protests against the communist regime in Cuba. As of this week, the Biden administration is still evaluating its options for how to respond. Last Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki noted that the protests on the island had largely stopped in the face of a police crackdown, calling the government's response unacceptable for violating Cubans' fundamental and universal rights. In entirely unrelated news, the U.S., for the first time in over 3 years, released one of the many prisoners held without trial and subjected to torture at the infamous prison complex at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that. I think you're talking about Abdulatif Nasser, right?
That's right, which actually was awesome to see. It was sort of the news alert came through on Monday morning, really kind of lifted my spirits for the day. He was the subject, Abdulatif Nasser, who was the prisoner who was released, was the subject of a really excellent Radiolab podcast miniseries last year called The Other Latif, which was hosted by the Radiolab producer also named Latif Nasser.
I commend that. Was it a separate podcast or was it part of the Radiolab feed?
Good question. We'll link it in the show notes.
It's really excellent, and what, you know, it's not giving too much away because you should absolutely go and listen to it. But I mean, what it goes through is just kind of the absurdity of this person's story. Like, really wrong place, wrong time. Didn't make some great decisions, but also wasn't a terrorist. Fairly obviously was not. I mean, talk about Twitter doctors. I just am like, I listen to a podcast and so I'm a terrorism expert. But I think there's a good point to be made that, like, I wonder how that bit of really eloquently presented investigative journalism actually had a positive impact on this person sort of being able to get free. And I hope he's back in, was it Morocco where he's from?
Morocco. He confirmed he is out of Moroccan custody. He is with his family. It's a really, really happy ending to that story.
Yeah, I would consider that good news.
But back to Cuba, Errol, the story shouldn't be diminished that there was a brutal crackdown on these protests, not entirely surprisingly, but including officers donning riot gear, which isn't typically seen in Cuba, including the arming of sort of loyalists to the regime with bats and other crude weapons and just kind of sending them out into the middle of protests. Really brutal stuff. Where do you think the situation in Cuba could go from here?
I think it's a good question. I mean, we talked about this last week. I hadn't, and I'm not a Brazil watcher, I'm not a close Cuba watcher, but it's Cuba, it's hard to ignore Cuba completely. both being in the United States and being sort of in foreign policy for my day job. And so, you know, when Cuba opened up during the Obama administration, there was sort of opening of diplomatic channels and some commercial channels. There were, you know, daily flights from the United States to Cuba, et cetera. It sort of signaled a new era-ish. And the ish is because then Donald Trump got elected president and we went back to ostracizing Cuba and antagonizing them and embargoing them and all of the things that had been the hallmark of U.S.-Cuba policy for decades that really hadn't resulted in anything other than kind of suffering for the Cuban people, I can probably say. It didn't result in the Castros getting out of power. You know, Fidel was in power basically until he died, and then Raul was in power basically until he died. I think there was sort of this hope during the Obama administration that things would change. And I think the reason I say that is because Biden had promised during the campaign to sort of revisit the Cuba policy, and he placed this emphasis on alleviating the suffering of the Cuban people. You know, when these protests started last Sunday, it was sort of, we talked about how it was driven by this one really interesting reggaeton song, and how, you know, 3G mobile technology was instrumental, and there was, you know, echoes of the Arab Spring.
As a side note, that song, Patria y Vida, absolute bop. We linked it in the show notes from last week on the News and Brews podcast, so go take a look. But
it's good. Yeah, my 4-year-old is like super into it, because we definitely rock it like in the morning on the way to preschool. Last week we talked about like, oh, this is exciting, but also they're probably going to crack down. And it wasn't because we had a crystal ball. It was because that was the most obvious course of action that a repressive Cuban regime would take. And they did. And so, you know, the protests have basically stopped. And Jen Psaki's quote that you talked about, you know, unacceptable and violating Cuban's fundamental and universal rights is all true. I think what it's resulted in, getting back to your question, is we're coming back to where we were in the pre-Obama times, where it's like there's human rights abuses by regimes all around the world, yet we still maintain diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia and, you know, other countries that have China and others that have sort of human rights issues and repress their people, et cetera, but Cuba's different, right? And so I think what you've seen is this sort of like red meat, red meaning communism, this sort of red meat being thrown into Congress. And so if Marco Rubio were king, I'm guessing we would have already invaded, but there's like calls on the right by him and others, especially in sort of the right wing media, to take quote unquote decisive action. Some are interpreting that as airstrikes. Some sort of ambitious warmongering types are thinking like, oh, are we going to send boots on the ground? You know, whatever that means to Cuba. We've sort of reserved.
Yeah, airstrikes is one interpretation. Another would be that Marco Rubio just wants to sound tough and has no fucking idea what he's talking about.
I think that that's a reasonable interpretation of what's happening, because like, I think nobody who actually has the ability to order airstrikes is even entertaining something like, I have no insider knowledge, but like, I would be extremely surprised if that were even relatively on the table, because like, they're repressing their people, their repressive regime, et cetera. I think what's interesting though, Mike, is, you know, you've got the red meat on the right, you know, anti-communism, et cetera, but it's not just that that is going to hinder the possibility of renormalization of relations, sort of going back to this Obama era plan, partly because some Democrats in Congress are talking in similarly tough, quote unquote, language. But I think it's, you know, Biden is also different from Obama. He hasn't really minced words. He's called Cuba a quote unquote failed state. And his senior director on the National Security Council, whose name is Juan Gonzalez, which baseball fans, this is not the longtime outfielder for the Rangers.
What a great player though in his day.
Oh man, yeah, I still have his baseball cards, like really, really solid player. Not that guy. This is the senior director for the Western Hemisphere on the National Security Council, literally said, Joe Biden is not Barack Obama in policy towards Cuba. So again, I think we're sort of back to this, Cuba is different, we're going to have this weird non-policy embargo is going to continue, and we're going to muddle through. and the Cuban people are going to continue to suffer.
I want to just throw out a couple of thoughts on this, and if you have answers, all the better. But like, why not? Like, I get, fair enough, that you're a different person than Barack Obama, but like, what is your justification, the Biden administration, for continuing this embargo? Like, what is the moral or intellectually honest policy ground to continue this embargo? The only thing that I could see is, you know, strategically, you could make a case that the first half of Biden's first term needs to be all about building coalitions within the U.S. and within Congress specifically to do things like infrastructure, which we've talked about in the past, in which case doing something like normalizing relations with Cuba would risk alienating a bunch of lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who you really need to maintain your majorities. Presumably in the midterms, either you'll expand your majorities and not have to worry about it as much, or you'll lose one or both majorities and also not have to worry about it as much. And this could be something they would save for the second half of the term. But beyond that, I don't see any moral or intellectual justification for this policy.
Yeah, but you could probably see political justification for it.
Florida.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Florida. So I think two quick thoughts. The sort of crackdown on the protests was basically all the excuse Republicans and some Dems needed to continue pandering to Cubans in Florida. I mean, upholding, U.S. commitment to human rights, et cetera. So, there is this sort of like thinly veiled human rights. Yeah. We support human rights, but really the Cuban exiles are very loud and they vote. And last election, they voted Republican more than they voted Democrat. And so I think there's some calculus there. I actually don't think that's what is necessarily driving the president. I think he just comes from, he's dealt with Cuba his entire political career. And I think that there's some scar tissue there. I think there have been efforts at reaching out to the Cuban. I mean, this is someone who was for the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? And I think there's is some scar tissue. There is some sort of lingering apprehension and historical justification. And this is why kind of Barack Obama as the quote unquote outsider and new person, like he had an opportunity with Ben Rhodes to just kind of reset things. And I think it's a little bit harder for people like Joe Biden who have been dealing with the same set of really malign characters for decades.
Yeah, always worth remembering that Joe Biden was born before the Iron Curtain came down over Eastern Europe.
Yeah, before. He saw it go up and then come down.
All right, moving on to some just really different in tone news. The Olympics are starting this week.
Yes, I love the Olympics.
And so athletes have started to arrive in Tokyo in advance of the opening ceremony on Friday. It has been widely reported that the organizers of the Tokyo Olympics are providing athletes beds with cardboard frames to prevent them from having sex with each other in an effort to prevent the spread of COVID. Now,
because COVID is a sexually transmitted disease.
The idea being they want to limit all social contact, and it's hard to have sex without social contact. The first thing to say though about this story is that it is completely false. And just like, you can sort of tell that by thinking
good
about
headline,
it for about
though.
2 seconds.
Good headline.
Right. So like, number one, these beds have been a part of the plans for the Olympic Village since before the pandemic. They were intended to reduce waste by using renewable materials. Two, the beds themselves can actually hold up to 440 pounds. One of the first people to disprove the fake news story here was Irish gymnast Reese McClenahan, who shared a video of himself jumping up and down aggressively on his quite sturdy cardboard bed.
Is sumo wrestling an Olympic sport?
It's interesting. I was looking this up. For a while, they were going to cut wrestling from this Olympics, but they ended up putting it back in, which is good because that would have been sad.
I mean, an Irish gymnast is one thing, but like, get me a Japanese sumo jumping up and down on that bed, and then I'll believe the 440 pounds.
You know, if nothing else, that would be a great PR stunt for the Japanese government.
And a great GIF. I would use that.
So the last point here, the first raised beds appeared in ancient Egypt 5,000 years ago. The earliest human appeared 2.8 million years ago, meaning for 99.8% of human history, people figured out the whole procreation thing just fine without a bed frame. Like, I think these elite athletes could figure it out too.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out to listeners that, like, this is not just a funny story about sex. Like, there's actually a lot of precedent for, like, Olympic villages are notorious. I'm sure that some public officials with sort of, sitting in dark basements with glasses on and drinking coffee at 10 p.m. were like, how do we limit the spread of COVID-19 at the Olympics? Oh, well, let's figure out, how to limit contact. That's not how the beds were developed, as Mike pointed out. But, like, I'm sure that there was someone talking about, like, hey, we should actually try to, enforce social distancing or something like
Well,
that.
so hold that thought. Hold that thought, because
Okay.
there's one more point on the bed specifically, which is to say this was a dumb story even by the standards of fake news. But next time you hear people talking about the dangers of social media spreading fake news, which may or may not happen later in this show, remember this list of publications that put out stories calling the beds anti-sex, including Yahoo News, SB Nation, The New York Post, Entrepreneur Magazine, The Irish Times, and many others.
So not social media.
Right, like very anti-social media.
Yeah, that's like old media.
But yes, to your point, the beds were not designed to prevent sex, but the organizers of the games are still really struggling with messaging their encouragement of social distancing while simultaneously cramming young people in the best shape of anyone in the world into a single dorm complex for 2 weeks. This led to one of my favorite headlines I've seen all year, which was Tokyo Olympics athletes warned not to use 160,000 free condoms.
Is that real? That's
That's
like a real headline.
from The Guardian. And so what happened was the organizers were asked what athletes should do with the 160,000 free condoms being distributed to them, as has been the case in every Olympics since 1988. This is like a standard
Yeah,
encouraged
this is
safe sex
standard
at the first
practice.
height
Yeah.
of the HIV pandemic at that time, responsible thing to do. And they basically, when they were asked this question, went red in the face and said that the condoms should be taken home and used to spread awareness of safe sex and HIV/AIDS. So nice save, guys. That was a close one.
Oh man. So I'm guessing that the NBC News team and others are gonna like talk about COVID, but also try to focus on the athletes and the competition. But like, let's be real, this is like gonna be a very weird Olympics. And there's just gonna be an asterisk next to everything. It's gonna be like the Barry Bond Olympics or something. Just there's a couple of things that I wanted to touch on because I'm an Olympics. I wouldn't say I'm an Olympics nerd. I just really like watching the Olympics. And so I will be up Friday morning because my kids will be up at 7 a.m. But I will, unlike I normally do, I won't have the TV off. I'll have it on and turn to NBC because 7 a.m. Eastern time on Friday is when the open ceremonies are on live. It's worth pointing out, though, that the open ceremonies are Friday, but the first action actually happens probably by the time people are listening to this on the podcast. The women's national soccer team is going to be playing Sweden on Wednesday, Japan time. And so it's already starting, folks. It's great, and I'm going to lose so much productivity, and it's going to be fantastic. As a reminder, women's national soccer team, great. Men's national soccer team failed to qualify. All they had to do in qualifying was to get to the semifinals in the CONCACAF region, which is sort of, Central America, North America, and the Caribbean. And we ended up losing to Honduras and have now missed the last several Olympics. In the men's game, it's worth pointing out that it's under 23. So it's sort of the under 23 national team versus the women who it's their full team. And basically FIFA negotiated that with the Olympics to make sure that the men, sort of the biggest tournament in the world, is still the World Cup, not the Olympics. Somehow the women figured it out, but the men couldn't. But this is sort of a story about life, I guess. The U.S. men's basketball team lost to Nigeria in the warm-ups. Let's hope that they got all of those bricks out of their system. I think there's going to be a lot of analysis. Like, I think it's completely likely that the U.S. men's basketball team, I mean, we all think about the Dream Team 1996 and like, U.S. has dominated basketball for forever. we invented the damn sport. But I think it's less a story, like, if we do lose, it's less a story about us getting worse, or like our players, our top players not going over, because why would they go over and get hurt, et cetera, et cetera. It's less a story about that, and it's more, if you look at some of the top NBA players right now, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo is Greek. You know, you've got all sorts of sort of Spanish and Latin American players, and it's, you know, everybody else has sort of risen their game. So it should be a more interesting tournament.
And that's a great thing, right? Like
And that's a great thing.
it's become a global game, and you see some real competition at the very highest level. Is awesome. It's going to be a blast to watch.
I think it's going to be great, and there's going to be so many Euro steps, and it's going to be wonderful.
And I think it's Greg Popovich is the coach, right?
He
The New York
is,
Knicks.
I think, yeah.
I mean, after the loss to Nigeria, he had a great comment in the press conference to that effect, just saying, you know, this is not going to be a tournament in the Olympics where the U.S. should be expected to blow out every team. It's not 1992. I think it's a good thing.
Just moving on with the Olympics real quickly, we've talked about COVID, but it's worth noting that, like, there's already been dozens of positive cases in the people. There's about 10,000 people I was reading that are kind of cleared to be in and around the Olympics. There's not going to be spectators per se, but there's a rather sizable group of people that are just going to be have to be in and around this. And there's dozens of them that have already tested positive. And so, you know, one of the reasons why I think this Olympics is just going to have an asterisk by it is things like it was a Czech beach volleyball player who tested positive. So he's going to have to quarantine for 14 days, which means he's going to miss all of his scheduled matches with his playing partner. And so, I
Can you
mean,
imagine like getting there and then having something like that happen?
it's devastating. I mean, thank you for pointing out like the impact on the athletes. I think it's sort of like, you know, I was thinking about the impact on the tournament, but like these are, like you mentioned earlier, like people who are in the peak of their like prime. And this is, anyways, it's hard to watch.
I don't know
But
if you need to feel for like the beach volleyball players as much as like, you know, if this were like a hammer throw or a weightlifter. You know, these people have been playing beach volleyball their whole lives to train for this. They'll be okay.
I don't know, man. I see what you're saying, but like, have you ever watched beach volleyball? They're really, really athletic.
Oh, not to diminish the athleticism at all, or the caliber of the sport. Just I think that's like a more fun sport to be practicing than most.
Well, speaking of fun sports, I was sort of thinking about, as I was going to talk about the Olympics, I was thinking about like, what am I going to be watching for? And so, in addition to skateboarding, sport climbing, and 3-on-3 basketball, all of which are going to be new
That's going to be.
sports, I will certainly be watching if there's going to be any protests. So, like, will Black Lives Matter make a showing? Will there be some sort of focus on mental health, like Naomi Osaka? Will somebody make a statement about Xinjiang and China and human rights? Just because, Mike, I mean, what's one of the most indelible images of the 20th century? Spoiler, it happened in the 1968 Olympics. Do you remember this?
Yeah, Tommy Smith and John Carlos.
Yeah, I mean, holding up
Great thing.
the sort of Black Power salute. This has been the year of athletes finding their voice, and now they're on the biggest possible stage.
Yeah, there's a really
So.
interesting conversation on this on the Sway podcast that Kara Swisher hosts. Her guest was Dick Pound, who is a member of the International Olympic Committee and founded the World Anti-Doping Agency. And they touched on this. And it sounds like the IOC has issued very clear guidelines to the athletes about what is and is not okay in terms of protesting, and you know, including like anything on the field of play during competition is not a place for political statements. Anything, and to your point about 1968, on the medal podium, not a place for protest. And so it'll be interesting to see if, one, to your question, are athletes expressing their voices, expressing their positions on these really global issues around social justice and
Right.
environmental justice and the other big issues that we talk about on this show? And are they doing it sort of in line with those guidelines, playing by the rules that have been put out by the powers that be at the Olympics? Or are they stepping out and making statements in ways that may be more visible but are also not sanctioned?
Yeah, I mean, I think this will be something that we come back to in the future, Mike, because I, you know, the Winter Olympics in 2022, do you know where they're going to be?
Beijing.
Beijing. There is some evidence that China is very involved in the IOC, as they're involved in all international institutions. And there's some evidence that in anticipation of the 2022 Beijing Olympics, they sort of pushed rather quietly, pushed through these new regulations that are prohibiting athlete protests. So something to watch for sure.
Yeah, that's next year too. How about that?
Yeah, because it's just been one long, I have to say, March 2020 has lasted a really long time.
We'll get past it soon.
Well, let's move on. That was a lot more than we had thought about on the Olympics, but I'm, again, a huge Olympics fan. So thanks for indulging me on that.
Yeah, no, let's come back to the U.S. So Facebook is in a spat with the Biden administration this week. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who ever since Bobby Jindal left public life has been our nation's primary source of Indian Urkel energy, said over the weekend that social media platforms are not doing enough to stop the spread of misinformation, specifically when it comes to vaccines. People in the administration, this being the Biden administration, have been gradually letting more of their frustration on this issue show publicly, really for months, including Chief of Staff Ron Klain saying that when they do focus groups of people who are resistant to getting the vaccine, they hear again and again that they are getting bad information on it, specifically from Facebook. This week, a report from the nonprofit Center for Countering Digital Hate found that just 12 people, dubbed the Disinformation Dozen, are responsible for 73% of anti-vaccine content.
73% of anti-vaccine content. From 12 people.
Yeah.
Like, why can't we just kick these 12 people off Facebook?
Well, this sort of came to a head on Friday when President Biden was asked by reporters what he thought about Facebook's measures. And he said, they're killing people. That's a direct quote. He later walked that back slightly, saying it's not, you know, it's the dozen bad actors on the platform who are most to blame and others spreading misinformation, but that Facebook should be doing a better job policing content on its platform. Facebook put out a blog post in response that was pretty slappy, I think, by the standards of corporate communications in response to presidential administrations. They basically said, Joe Biden, we know you missed your goal of 70% vaccinated by the 4th of July, but it's not our fault.
Yeah, like, it was not ideal. I also feel like after 4 years of a president saying the quiet part out loud, it was like a little jarring to hear Joe Biden go off script and say the quiet part out loud. But now we know how he really feels.
Yeah, you sort of wonder like what the machinations have been in the administration around this, because it has been a slow roll. Like there has clearly been a coordinated build of the messaging. And he must have known that he was going to get a question about this, given that he semi-walked back what he said. You have to think that he didn't speak exactly as he intended to. But I also, it wasn't totally out of line with the messaging to date. And I think it got a lot more attention on this issue, including this very podcast, the fact that he used that language.
Yeah, super interesting. It was sort of like on a Friday, I think, when he said that they're killing people thing. And I was thinking about disconnecting for a little while. And I was like, oh, wait, never mind. Going to come back online for a second.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, there's a couple of problems, like immediate problems with Facebook's position on this. They really come down to like the way they communicate and the level of openness they have. I believe that they are sincere. And I think reporting from inside Facebook has said that Mark Zuckerberg himself is quite passionate about promoting vaccines. And, you know, through the official channels they have, they do that fairly vigorously. But, you know, they say things like, we've removed 18 million pieces of COVID-19 misinformation from our platform, but they don't say how many they've left up, right? They say that they've reduced the visibility or flagged 167 million pieces of false information, but they don't share how many people actually saw those lies before and after they were flagged, right? It's all numerators and happy talk and no denominators or reckoning with the scale of the problem.
Yeah, proportion would be helpful here, right, in determining whether that's actually, I mean, it sounds like a lot and that's what they want you to think, but if it's out of like 3 gazillion, then that's not actually that much.
Right. And that's not even the hardest problem, right? The harder problem is that Facebook has been nurturing the growth of these communities centered on misinformation for years. Some of the earliest was the anti-vax movement, pre-COVID anti-vax movement. Then it was QAnon, other conspiratorial groups. Now it's centered on vaccine conspiracies. They say that they're serious about combating misinformation, but you know, I'm not the first person to describe that as trying to get the toothpaste back in the tube, right? Once these communities are out there, once they are trusting one another or other bad actors more than any official source of information, it's very hard to reverse that inertia. And I think in this case, the problem, the fundamental problem is that they're still not being open with their data. So the toothpaste is out of the tube, and maybe it's even like on your face, right? And then the person who squeezed it all out is like, oh no, look, I got 10 milliliters of toothpaste back in the tube. I'm not going to show you a mirror so you can see your face. You know, you may be hearing from some people that you have toothpaste all over your face. But look how much is back in the tube now.
Right. I feel like Facebook should have toothpaste. They should like make Facebook branded toothpaste and like have a video, one of those like flashy, really how-to videos. Like, here's how we put all of the misinformation.
News and brews merch ideas. That's a trick.
News and brews toothpaste. We're going to put it back in the tube.
Let's stick with the internet. We haven't talked too much about cybersecurity in a while, but there have been lots of developments. You know, we did a full conversation months ago around the Colonial Pipeline hack, and then we touched on the hack of JBS, the large meat processor. But as of last week, the Russia-based groups behind both of those attacks, DarkSide and Revil, which stands for Ransomware Evil, and that's just really lazy naming. But their presences on the dark web had essentially disappeared. You know, their landing pages, their customer support sites, the dedicated sites they had for specific ransomware demands, all of it had disappeared from the dark web. And there was a lot of speculation, but not much clarity on why or how that happened.
You know, in true Russian fashion, they just quietly disappeared.
Right. Exactly. And you know, Biden had put out some pretty aggressive statements shortly before that and kind of an ultimatum to Putin. But it's not clear if, you know, basically they could have disappeared whether Putin responded favorably to that ultimatum or not, right? Whether it was by force from within the Russian state or by force from U.S. cyber capabilities.
Yeah. No, I think one of the points is that this has been an issue up until this week. This has been an issue of Russia-based hackers and ransomware evil people sort of conducting attacks on the U.S. and elsewhere around the world with either the support or at least the approval and knowledge of the Russian government. But I think this week was a little bit different.
Yeah, so this week the news was not about Russia, but about Chinese hacking efforts. And specifically that China had launched a large attack on Microsoft Exchange. And the response to it, I think, was really interesting, which was basically coordinated messaging from NATO countries and other allies, essentially behind the leadership of the U.S., using really aggressive language to say that this needed to stop.
Yeah. So during the Trump years, there was so much talk about being tough on China. And so there was all this kind of the, we're going to erect trade barriers and we're going to sanction people or whatever. This was an actual tough response against China, at least in words. I mean, we'll see how tough it is as it moves on. But like literally half the world was like slapping China's wrists after this. In a very coordinated, like the messaging was coordinated, the timing was coordinated. I mean, there was some serious, I mean, they got the attention of China for sure.
I think the slap on the wrist is a good choice of words because it's not like when the U.S. condemned Russian hacking efforts and actually sanctioned Russian leaders and, you know, put real constraints on Russia's ability to continue such efforts. There were no hard measures attached to this one, though there was a lot of tough talk.
I mean, not yet, right? Like, I think this is with Russia, they're all talk, or, you know, what's the saying? They're all bark and no bite, or very little bite. And I think with China, there's a potential for a fairly large bite. And so I think that the conversations right now are not, you know, about like, should we do something? I think the conversations are about what is a proportional response. Because let's be clear, like this wasn't the Chinese government hacking or doing ransomware attacks on the U.S. government. This was government-affiliated hackers with a group known as Hafnium that perpetrated this hack of Microsoft Exchange email server software. And so it's, you know, you're not going to go and like turn out the lights on a Chinese city. You're not going to hack their power grid. It sort of needs to be a proportional response. And so I think what's happening or what should be happening is probably they're figuring out what does a proportional response to something like this look like? And how can we make it as coordinated as possible with our partners? This is not about like sanctioning an oligarch so he can't go to Monaco. This is like, it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's hard for a few reasons to assess this. And bear with me for a second, because I think there's a very tired, very sad four-year-old walking into the room right now.
So yeah, I hear it.
Quick. So I think it's really hard to assess the relative response to Russian and Chinese hacking efforts, in part because so much of it is under cloak and dagger or just not publicly visible.
Yeah.
And we have a way of knowing what's happening that really does hurt the actors involved in these situations. But at some point, some of it, you know, a response to very public hacks of U.S. major corporations and infrastructure has to have some publicly visible component to be meaningful, right? Like there's just, we can't sort of keep this under wraps forever. It's also hard because, to your point, Errol, like we can put individual sanctions on members of the Russian klepto state and have, you know, a somewhat real impact on their decision-making and their incentives. And China is just a much larger global actor, right? It's a much bigger deal to go after anything that really matters to them. I don't know. I do think we have to start doing something that is visible at some point in the near future. We can't just continue letting these things happen again and again. But what that is, I'm certainly not qualified to say.
Well, and I think this is definitely something that we're going to talk about in the future, Mike, because this is an evolving story for sure. I think that China has capabilities unlike just about any country in the world other than maybe our own. And it's the degree of sophistication, not only in their cyber, but in their kind of national security apparatus and government. I mean, it's very significant. This is not the China of the 1980s and 90s. I mean, this is a very sophisticated country with a very sophisticated government with a suite of tools that's pretty scary. I think that, like I said before, what I'll be watching is the degree to which the U.S. can kind of hold together this coalition of allies and friends and partners and basically saying that this is not okay and then putting some teeth behind that this is not okay. Because China is... as much as they, you know, they've denied this, it's worth pointing out that they have denied this and said it was all fabricated, I think was the word that they used. But as much as they deny, you know, and say it didn't happen, they do actually really care what people think about them and they care about what their image is on the global stage. And so this multilateral allies and friends approach is probably going to be more successful than Donald Trump yelling into Twitter, I would hope, but it's certainly going to be something to watch in the weeks to come.
Yeah, I think you're right to kind of bring it out to the broader context of U.S. China and multinational China relations. The cover story this week of The Economist is actually about just this, about Biden's China doctrine. They're quite critical of the level of confrontation and the undercurrents of protectionism in the administration's policies or stated policies or demonstrated policies to date toward China. But I don't know, I think we can talk more about it in another episode. I think their criticisms sort of fail to acknowledge that there aren't a whole lot of better options out there at the moment, given China's responses in the past to more open and engagement-oriented strategies. That being said, you know, you're absolutely right, Errol. This will be something to watch and certainly something we'll come back to on News and Brews.
Because we do this every week. And it's on Tuesday nights on Green Room and Wednesday night in your pod feed. And so we will talk about stories from the past and things will rear their heads and we'll be able to refer back to stuff that we talked about and we'll be able to talk about how wrong we were and it'll be great.
Awesome. Well, Errol, what do you think about the stories we talked about tonight?
I think we were wrong on, I'm just kidding. We fixed them. Obviously we fixed them.
We fixed it.
We fixed the Olympics, Mike.
That's right. Good on us.
Well, thanks for joining, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yavoke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. News and Brews recordings happen live each Tuesday evening at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Join the live conversation on Green Room or listen to the podcast available on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.